a chapter out of The Majesty of Calmness by William George Jordan. Calmness is the rarest quality in human life. It is the poise of a great nature in harmony with itself and its ideals. It is the moral atmosphere of a life self-centered, self-reliant, and self-controlled. Calmness is singleness of purpose, absolute confidence, and conscious power, ready to be focused in an instant to meet any crisis. The Sphinx is not a true type of calmness. Petrifaction is not calmness, it is death, the silencing of all the energies. While no one lives his life more fully, more intensely, and more consciously than the man who is calm. The fatalist is not calm. He is the coward slave of his environment, hopelessly surrendering to his present condition, recklessly indifferent to his future. He accepts his life as a rudderless ship drifting on the ocean of time. He has no compass, no chart, no known port to which he is sailing. His self-confessed inferiority to all nature is shown in his existence of constant surrender. It is not calmness. The man who is calm has his course in life clearly marked on his chart. His hand is ever on the helm. Storm, fog, night, tempest, danger, hidden reefs, he is prepared and ready for them. He is made calm and serene by the realization that in these crises of his voyage, he needs a clear mind and a cool head, that he has naught to do but to do each day the best he can by the light he has, that he will never flinch nor falter for a moment, that though he may have to tack and leave his course for a time, he will never drift. He will get back into the true channel. He will keep ever headed toward his harbor. When he will reach it, how he will reach it, matters not to him. He rests in calmness, knowing he has done his best. If his best seems to be overthrown or overruled, then he must still bow his head in calmness. To no man is permitted to know the future of his life, the finality. God commits to man only new beginnings, new wisdom, and new days to use the best of his knowledge. Calmness comes from within. It is the peace and restfulness of the depths of our nature. The fury of storm and of wind agitate only the surface of the sea. They can penetrate only 200 or 300 feet. Below that is the calm, unruffled deep. To be ready for the great crises of life, we must learn serenity in our daily living. Calmness is the crown of self-control. When the worries and cares of the day fret you and begin to wear upon you, and you chafe under the friction, be calm. Stop, rest for a moment, and let calmness and peace assert themselves. If you let these irritating outside influences get the better of you, you are confessing your inferiority to them by permitting them to dominate you. Study the disturbing elements, each by itself. Bring all the willpower of your nature to bear upon them, and you will find that they will, one by one, melt into nothingness, like vapors fading before the sun. The glow of calmness that will then pervade your mind, the tingling sensation of an inflow of new strength, may be to you the beginning of the revelation of the supreme calmness that is possible for you. Then, in some great hour of your life, when you stand face to face with some awful trial, when the structure of your ambition and life work crumbles in a moment, you will be brave. You can then fold your arms calmly, look out undismayed and undaunted upon the ashes of your hope, built upon the wreck of what you have faithfully built. And with brave heart and unfaltering voice, you may say, "So let it be, I will build again." When the tongue of malice and slander, the persecution of inferiority, tempt you for just a moment to retaliate, when for an instant you forget yourself so far as to hunger for revenge, be calm. When the gray heron is pursued by its enemy, the eagle, it does not run to escape. It remains calm, takes a dignified stand, and waits quietly, facing the enemy unmoved, with the terrific force with which the eagle makes its attack. The boasted king of birds is often impaled and run through on the quiet, lance-like bill of the heron. The means that man takes to kill another's character becomes suicide of his own. No man in the world ever attempted to wrong another without being injured in return, some way, somehow, sometime. The only weapon of offense that nature seems to recognize is the boomerang. Nature keeps her books admirably. She puts down every item. She closes all accounts finally, but she does not always balance them at the end of the month. To the man who is calm, revenge is so far beneath him that he cannot reach it, even by stooping. When injured, he does not retaliate. He wraps around him the royal robes of calmness, and he goes quietly on his way. When the hand of death touches the one we hold dearest, paralyzes our energy, and eclipses the sun of our life, the calmness that has been accumulating in long years becomes in a moment our refuge, our reserve strength. The most subtle of all temptations is the seeming success of the wicked. It requires moral courage to see, without flinching, material prosperity coming to men who are dishonest, to see politicians rise into prominence, power, and wealth by trickery and corruption, to see virtue in rags and vice in velvets, to see ignorance at a premium and knowledge at a discount. To the man who is really calm, these puzzles of life do not appeal. He is living his life as best he can. He is not worrying about the problems of justice, whose solution must be left to omniscience to solve. When man has developed the spirit of calmness until it becomes so absolutely part of him that his very presence radiates it, he has made great progress in life. Politicians rise into prominence, power, and wealth by trickery and corruption. To see virtue in rags and vice in velvets, to see ignorance at a premium and knowledge at a discount. To the man who is really calm, these puzzles of life do not appeal. He is living his life as best he can. He is not worrying about the problems of justice, whose solution must be left to omniscience to solve. When man has developed the spirit of calmness until it becomes so absolutely part of him that his very presence radiates it, he has made great progress in life. Calmness cannot be acquired of itself and by itself. It must come as the culmination of a series of virtues. What the world needs and what individuals need is a higher standard of living, a great realization of the privilege and dignity of life, a higher and nobler conception of individuality. With this great sense of calmness permeating an individual, man becomes able to retire more into himself, away from the noise, the confusion, and strife of the world, which come to his ears only as faint, far-off rumblings, or as the tumult of the life of a city heard only as a buzzing hum by the man in a balloon. The man who is calm does not selfishly isolate himself from the world, for he is intensely interested in all that concerns the welfare of humanity. His calmness is but a holy of holies into which he can retire from the world to get strength to live in the world. He realizes that the full glory of individuality, the crowning of his self-control, is the majesty of calmness. That is a tremendous chapter, and if everyone could live like that, how wonderful it would be. I'd like to read to you this evening from Isaiah chapter 26, beginning with verse 1. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Open ye the gates, that the righteous nation which keepeth the truth may enter in. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. Trust ye in the Lord forever, for in the Lord Jehovah is everlasting strength. I want to talk to you tonight about experiencing the ecstasy of God. The master wrote a tremendous lesson on that. And I'm going to refer to it to make sure that you get all of it. I remember right after he wrote this, and he wrote this lesson personally, I was down at headquarters at that particular time, and one of the disciples who had charge of getting the lesson typed and into lesson form made the statement, "I don't know why he put all of this into one lesson. It should be put into three or four." But apparently the master thought he knew best, so he put it all into one lesson. You know, there was once a man who went to a doctor. He was filled with nervousness and with tension. He didn't know what to do for himself because he had tried many doctors. He'd been given various kinds of medication, and nothing had worked. But this doctor whom he went to, and to whom he was referred by a very good friend, was an unusual type of doctor. So he listened to the man's story about all of his worries, all of his troubles, all of his tensions, and he said, "I'll write you out a prescription." And the prescription that he wrote was, "Get rid of tension and live relaxed. Follow this prescription religiously and you should get well." Well, the man couldn't see how in the world this was going to help him. He wasn't given any medication. He wasn't given any particular instructions for exercising or relaxing or any of the things that would help him to get through tension. And so he went to a minister, and he discussed his problem with the minister. And the minister said, "I see what he means, certainly." He said, "Well, what does this sentence, 'get rid of tension, live relaxed,' mean to me? I don't know what to do about it." He suggests, "But you forget what the doctor followed it up with. He said, 'Follow this prescription religiously, and you shall get well.'" Now, that one word, religiously, injected in there, made all the difference in the world. Because if you get rid of your attention, your worries, religiously, indeed you will be well. And the way to do that, of course, is to focus your attention fully upon God. The Old Testament is full of prescriptions for the release of tension and nervousness, as is also the New Testament, if we would but search the Bible for them. It's an amazing thing how you can get help. This one little book that I've recommended to you so many times, that has something as spoken from the Christ every day to the two little ladies. I've forgotten just what the name of it is now. But anyway, you can open that book any place. And somehow, no matter what you are concerned with at the moment, that book seems to have an answer for you. It's an amazing thing. God Calling, that's the name of it. And so he is. He's calling to us every moment of our lives. And if we will only approach all of our problems through God, we will find that our whole lives will change. That which was formerly causing us nervousness, tension, worry, burdens upon our backs, will be relieved, and we will go about with happiness and with calmness, as this other article said. You know, it is really something to be calm when you are tested to the hilt. I have been away from you, with one exception of one Sunday, for quite some time now. And I've been going through many, many experiences, as I'm sure all of you have been, because my absence has been a test to everyone who has been with me for a long time. And the ones that are faithful are still here. They don't drop away, but they come and they support the work, and they support the faithful and wonderful people that are trying to serve God in them. And therefore, by so doing, they too, in their turn, are serving God in the most wonderful way. You know, after any spiritual teacher leaves, if that one has a following of any sort, it would be a sorry thing to think that their life work was ruined, that it was availed nothing if everything was lost and people failed to come because that one had left the body. I saw it happen to some degree when my own guru passed on. But yet, through the ones who were faithful to him, they carried on the work. And today, there are hundreds and thousands all over the world following his teachings. This means a great deal, believe me. It means more than I can tell you, because this work is not done for the individual, but it is done for God. It is done so that man may find the truth within himself, that he may become a better person, that he may have a better life, that he may contact God, who is to be found only within himself. You know, an analogy could be used of the moon reflecting in many, many pots. And the moon can be likened to God, and the reflection can be likened to the individual souls that are in the earth, or on the earth, I should say. And this light reflects into the many. It is the same analogy, or the same type of analogy, as that of the gas burner, where there is one pilot light underneath, and as you light the top part and turn the handle, then that one pilot light underneath brings forth all of the little sparks up through the gas burner. And so it is with God. He is the one eternal light that illumines this whole universe, and we are the individual sparks. And as the globe which covers the light bulb, if it breaks, then the energy which was in it goes back to the main dynamo. So it is with each soul. As that soul departs, that one goes back to the main dynamo, because there is no such thing as death. Don't forget that God is the living spirit, the living presence within us. And we but wear a garment of flesh, which one day, because it wears out, because it gets diseased, or because it's just plain tired, it has to be dissolved. But that infinite spark of life, which is God within us, leaves the body. But it continues to live, because God is eternal. God is infinite. We but go into a different, a deeper sleep. You know, in the Bible it says, I die daily. And so it is, because every night when you go to sleep, you die a minor death. You are not conscious of the fact even that the world exists, that you as an individual exist when you're asleep. Yet in the morning, do you not awaken and put on a new garment and go forth to the dawn of a new day? And so it is with what we call the physical death. We take this garment off, we have a little deeper sleep, and then we come forth and we don a new garment and go forth to the dawn of a new existence. And whatever we have done in this particular incarnation, we take with us. We cannot take our clothes, we cannot take our belongings, we cannot take our relatives, our friends, our loved ones, or any of our accomplishments, with the exception of that which we have built within our souls, within our consciousness. We have free choice every moment of our lives as to whether we are going to work in harmony with God's laws or work against his law. And as a result of that, we either reward or punish ourselves. So it behooves us to keep our full attention upon God, to practice all of the Ten Commandments that Moses gave us. These are the laws which govern and control man, and the man who disobeys those laws punishes himself. The man who works in harmony with God, who loves him, whose devotion for him is greater than his love and his devotion for himself or anyone or anything else, is the one who is going to take an eternal treasure with him. And the next time he dons a new garment, he is going to be so much more advanced than he was before. He's going to have a greater opportunity and a greater destiny to fulfill. This is all of life. We see it throughout all of nature, with the trees seemingly dying every fall, the leaves falling off, the fruit has been plucked off the trees or fallen to the ground, and then the seeds again take root, and every year the sap renews itself in the tree, and it grows a little more, its flowers are more beautiful, its fruit is more abundant, and so it grows and grows until it gives forth the full fragrance, the full harvest of its own being. And that is the point to which every man must come to. He must explore the cavern of his own heart. He must explore this tremendous universe of his own being, because he has not been taught any of the inner things, any of the power centers that he has within himself. He hasn't been taught that he has a whole universe inside, and that it is his blessed privilege to explore that universe, and that all things, if he does what he should, will be made known to him. Now, the Master wrote this lesson about how to go into ecstasy at will. Now, in order to begin this, you have to learn to go to sleep at will. Now, you cannot go to sleep when you're running, when you're tasting, smelling, feeling, hearing, seeing. You go to sleep when you are not doing any of those things. Now, sometimes you fight sleep. And the reason you fight it, of course, is because you have so many worries on your mind, or so many things to do. You're thinking about this, what you have planned, or you're worrying about what you don't have, or some adversity that has come into your life. Do you not know that adversity is one of the greatest tools to attain God realization there is? Because you must have that opposition in order to grow. You cannot grow without adversity. If this world was all going along smoothly, where would be the incentive, the inspiration for anybody to go ahead? Because pain comes, because suffering comes, because adversity comes. We have no place to look but up. Now, whether or not we believe in God, there is one. We cannot fail to deny that there is a higher intelligence that works meticulously to keep this whole universe and all of the stellar systems beyond working in perfect harmony. Sometimes we have tremendous upheaval in nature, but that in many cases is what man himself sends forth from himself. And when you think of the number of individuals in the world, all thinking, speaking, acting, sending out vibrations for themselves, and for every action there is an opposite and equal reaction. Look at yourself and ask, what do you send out to the world? Do you send love and kindness? Do you send love of God? Do you send devotion to Him? Do you love your neighbor as yourself? Do you give service wherever is possible? Do you work for God alone? Or do you work for your own selfish gain? Or because of your pride of accomplishment? What could any one of us accomplish if it were not that God gives us the power to think, to breathe, to move, to live, to have our being? We couldn't even lift a finger without that. So our thoughts should be upon Him, and no matter how difficult the task is, the job is, how unpleasant it is, if you are calm and you do everything for Him alone to the best of your ability, regardless of the treatment you get, believe me, you will benefit from it, and the time will come when you will be lifted out of where you are and into something much better, because that is the law. Because as ye sow, so shall ye reap. We've talked many times about the fact of whether or not we plant weeds in our garden or seeds that will grow roses. And if you plant the seed of a weed, you are for sure going to get a weed that will grow up. And they grow so rapidly. They seem to grow much better than anything else. And if you plant the seed of a rose, a beautiful bush will come, and finally the most beautiful flower with the greatest fragrance. How wonderful it is. And yet we are each the flower of God when you stop to think about it. Each of us is a flower of God. And we have that fragrance of spirit within us. And it is an actual fact that when you get to a certain state of spiritual consciousness and development, that your whole being exudes that fragrance, and anyone around you is drawn to you. It's just like a magnet. It's like the deer that smells the musk and sometimes goes to his death because he's running after it, and yet it is within himself. It's a strange thing. Now, let us talk about going to sleep at will. You actually can. So many people say that they can't go to sleep. Night after night after night after night, they fight sleep. But in any case, you can go to sleep, and you can will to go to sleep. Now, you can either lie down or sit up. But let us say that we're going to lie down first, and we're going to tense all the body. Take your each foot in turn, each ankle in turn, each leg in turn, each thigh in turn, and so on until you have tensed every single part of your body individually, and then relax it. Now, what have you done in that connection? You have sent energy to your body. You have sent it to all the body parts. Now, if you have one particular part of your body that is ailing, if you will concentrate on that particular part of your body and tense it gently, don't strip your gears. Remember, do it like a car. Put it in low, medium, high, gently. And then tense with will, relax, and feel. And you will have sent that power, that energy of healing to your body. This body has been through a great deal. Some of you have seen it grow through a great deal, but still it's been doing it all of its life. But nevertheless, I have willed myself out of many, many things. I have helped myself by doing just exactly these things. And they do work. Now, you throw the breath out, and then you forget to breathe, even though you might still be breathing. Forgetting breath is a condition of sleep. While you sleep, you forget breath, even though you breathe less and rhythmically. As soon as you are awake, you breathe, and you become aware of your body and of the world. Now, another thing you do is to cease to think. Do you think you can do that? It's not an easy thing to do, to relax your mind and cease to think. But you can do it. Be indifferent to the sounds or the feeling of your body. Forget the taste in your mouth or the smell in your nostrils. Go to sleep anytime, anywhere. Dump and dissolve your body into the subconscious or slumberland, and forget it. Then you will consciously learn to be half asleep or fully awake. Make your mind feel that you haven't gone to sleep for a week, and that you feel so sleepy that you can sleep while traveling in an auto driven by somebody else, or sitting on a park bench, or in your room on a sofa. A master told a story about the fact that he learned to do this. He said that you must learn to do it either when you're perfectly still and by yourself, or in the midst of the greatest noise. So he used to practice this in a car. And he usually had a car full of people with him, so if he didn't want to listen to their chatter, he would practice this thing of going to sleep and of waking himself at will. And I'll tell you a strange little story in connection with myself. I was visiting him one time for 3 days, and he invited me to drive up to Los Angeles with him, and he had one of the girls driving his car, and I think Mr. Perón from Mexico City was also with us. I was sitting up in front with the driver, and he and Mr. Perón were sitting in the back. I went sound asleep, and all of a sudden I was just brought out of that sleep like that, and I sat up straight just as I heard him say, "Mildred," and he wanted to ask me a question. But it happened, you see. I woke up before he asked me, because the power of his thought was so great that he had the power to do this. Anyway, he learned to do this, and he kept on doing this, and he could destroy the tediousness of long journeys, he said. Now, after you learn to sleep it well, you have to learn to wake it well, because there are some people, when they once get themselves to sleep, don't want to wake up for 24 hours. And you can't do that, you know. So if you are going to be the master of your mind, of your body, and control yourself and your life, then you have to be able to really control all of these different factors of your being. So you not only learn to go to sleep at will, but you learn to wake up at will. So the way that you do this is to keep your awake for by half opening your eyes for half a minute or two at first, and then go to sleep at once. Learn to sleep and wake up at will alternately as many times as you can, anytime, anywhere, a noisy or a quiet place. Then as you are falling asleep at will and are three-fourths sleepy with eyes closed, half open your eyes and remain awake for half a minute or so. Then close your eyes, become three-fourths sleepy again. Then hold open your eyes and remain awake for a little while. Keep half asleep and half awake alternately at will as many times as you can. Then learn to close your eyes and instantaneously sleep soundly for 5 minutes. Then command your mind to wake you and remain awake with half-opened eyes for a minute. Then go back to sleep. Now, I saw the master do this many, many times on the platform. He was always demonstrating these things. And so he would really go to sleep. And he would always invite doctors to come up and to examine him to make sure that he wasn't pulling any tricks. And he has the power to control his breath completely, as I have told you. And at that time, you could feel no pulse beat, no heartbeat. His body was in a state of suspended animation. And some of the doctors accepted his invitation and went up and examined him, and they could find no tricks whatsoever. He actually had this control over his being. There are many people. I remember one time that I saw a man, he was a hatha yogi, and he lay down on a bed of swords. And these swords were very, very sharp, but he put himself into this yogic state, and he lay down on this bed of swords. And when he got up, you could see the cuts in his back, and the blood was running from them, but just like that, he stopped it. Somebody wiped off the blood, and there was no more bleeding. But after he came out of this state, he drank just, it seemed, almost a gallon of water, because they dry out their system when they go into this particular thing. Now, we, of course, are in the subconscious state when we are sleeping. But still, we have really gone beyond the subconscious. We are never totally unaware of what's going on, because when we awake in the morning, we know whether or not we've had a good sleep. We know whether we've had nightmares or sweet dreams, or whether our sleep has been restless, or whether we've had a peaceful sleep. So there is something beyond the sleep state that is operating at all times. Now, after mastering the above technique, your mind will be able to sleep 15 minutes to 6 hours or more and wake you up at a definite time. Before you go to sleep at night, command your subconscious mind to wake you up at 5 or 6 or 10 minutes before 5 or 6 a.m. or at any time, and it will do so. Suggest to your subconscious, never-sleeping mind just before you sleep to wake you at a certain time or to get rid of a bad habit. You must make your specific wish very intense until you fall asleep with it. Then it will work. Now, this is very, very interesting, and I want to call your attention to this. If you practice this exercise in the way that it has been taught here, and as I'm describing it to you, when you get into this in-between waking and sleeping period, if you will put forth a thought to correct some bad habit that you have and make it so intense that you wish it, you want it, you desire it, you demand it with everything you have, and you do this day after day as you go to sleep in this state or in the in-between state, you will find that you will have it, your wish come true. It will come to pass. Actually, You live in three worlds, you see. You live in the subconscious, the conscious, and the superconscious world. But mostly we're only aware of the subconscious and the conscious. But we have a whole new world of spiritual consciousness within ourselves. And it is this state in between where you go into this world beyond and you experience the bliss of God. Now, when you can actually control this waking and this sleeping and stay in this in-between period and fix your mind fully upon God, you can go into the state of bliss of ecstasy. Now, this is the practicing which is most important to you. You can actually go into the state of ecstasy. This is how you contact the dimensions beyond the world which we are living in. That is how eventually you can contact or get knowledge about anything that you want. There have been many, many instances where this has been proven. This is not just a figment of my imagination or the Master's or anyone else's. This actually occurs. It is a definite knowing. It is a thing which has come to me for many, many years. It isn't that I see visions like many people do. They actually will put their full attention at this optic thalamus gland, which is the spiritual eye. Because don't forget, this eye, or this gland, furnishes the light by which these two eyes see. So it's in a triangle, so to speak. And as you close these two eyes and fix your full attention up here, thinking about God alone, then gradually lights will appear. And maybe you won't see the spiritual eye right away. But eventually you will, if you persist. Perhaps certain visions will come, but brush them aside. You are after the president of the universe. And he is that one which is the life within you, your very self, your real self. Not the ego, which is but the ghost of the real self or God within you. Not that human ego. But rather, you want to contact God, and then you will be filled with the power of the Holy Ghost, or the divine ego, the spirit of God within you. Because as long as you have a form, there is a form, and the purity of spirit may be within you, but still it is a ghost of that real self or pure spirit which is beyond form and from which all forms emanate. Now you learn to go into ecstasy at will, first in a quiet place and then in a noisy place. You inhale, exhale 12 times with half open eyes. Look up at the point between the eyebrows. Expel breath, forgetting it entirely. Dissolve your body consciousness and thoughts and sleepiness of any at once into the superconscious, ever increasing joy of deep inward concentration. By closing the eyes and forgetting breath, you have learned to go to sleep instantaneously, dissolving body consciousness. Remember, you are not the body. You inhabit a body. You have a body. You have a mind. You have a soul. And it is that eternal spirit within you who dwells in this house of the Lord. Now, by keeping your eyes half open, pointed upward at the point between the eyebrows, you must instantaneously enjoy and be intoxicated with the cocktail of the joys of many sleeps consciously. With half-open eyes, learn to remain half-awake and half-asleep, and you will learn to go into ecstasy or the state of consciously sleeping at will. Now, sleep is a negative way of knowing you are not a man or a woman, but an invisible, joyous soul made in the image of blissful God. When you sleep, you are not unconscious, but semi-conscious. By learning to sleep at will, consciously, with half-open eyes, you will feel a greater and greater joy or ecstasy or superconsciousness and intuitively sense your soul. Why not learn the lesson of God in sleep? If every night you are forced in a negative way to forget your mortal existence, your nationality, sex, and possessions, and made to know you are a happy soul sleeping in a particle of space, even as God is the largest soul or manifested spirit, consciously sleeping in all space beyond all material vibrations, then it is true that sleep teaches you negatively that you are a little happy soul occupying a small space and made after the image of the largest ever newly blissful soul of all space. But by consciously enjoying ecstasy, a state similar too, but more blissful than the state of sleep. You gradually learn that you are not a little soul sleeping in a portion of space, but one with the largest soul, consciously, quiescently blissful in all space. Now, remember that you die 365 days a year. But when you die to the things of the human ego, then you have given up that which you call your own, and you are filled with the ecstasy and the bliss of God. Then you are a totally different being. Patty and I had some very interesting experiences. She went down to San Francisco with me to attend the wedding which I performed last Saturday in Santa Rosa. And I think just about everything happened before that to go wrong that could possibly have gone wrong. And to speak of a great soul and calmness, I think this girl who was married and who has been with me for many years certainly demonstrated it. I'll tell you a little bit about it because it's interesting. I'm sure she wouldn't mind. In the first place, the best man at the last moment couldn't help officiate at the wedding. So there had to be a substitute for him. That sort of threw everything in. Then she didn't know whether I was coming until the last minute because I'd been ill. And so that was all in a turmoil. She didn't know whether to try to get somebody else because the invitations had been sent out, or to wait and pray, or what should happen. And she didn't know if her folks were coming down, but they finally came down, and her future husband's folks came down. So everybody was there. But when we got to the church wasn't open. And so we had to send someone out to call to see if we could get the church open. Well, finally, after we had waited a while, there was a man, he looked like he was well along in his 80s, came doddering along and opened the door for us. And we walked in, and this was a different kind of a church than I'd ever worked in. It was a church in the round. And as we walked in, it wasn't the cleanest place in the world, so Patty and I had to go to work and pick up the petals off the floor from flowers and rearrange things. And there was supposed to be a table there for the incense burner, only they had removed the table that we were supposed to use, and there was a huge one which we couldn't use, and we had to finally wind up by using a kitchen step stool with two steps on it, painted brown. It was just plain wood. And so finally, anyway, we had to keep everybody outside. People kept coming until we finished. And so we finished, and the people all filed in. But then the organist failed to appear. So again, we had to send someone out to call the minister, who alone knew where the organist was. And so he made the comment, well, she thought it was at 1 o'clock, but he himself had made arrangements to have the church opened and ready at 12 o'clock. And this girl had talked to her just 2 days before, told her it was going to be 12 o'clock, told her what she wanted, and anyway, she wasn't there. She thought it was 1 o'clock. So we got the minister, and he said he would get in touch with the organist and that she was on her way. So then we had to have someone announce to the congregation that we would be delayed because the organist was delayed. So everybody got out and went out into the sunshine and talked and ambled around until the organist came. So then they all finally filed in, and it was time, and she started to play, only she muffed her lines. She, I guess, was so nervous because she was late that she didn't know how to play Here Comes the Bride. Anyway, we got through with that, and we hadn't had a chance for a full rehearsal, and so I had to take the wedding just cold and direct everybody as we went along. But the wedding went beautifully. I just put it all in God's hands, remained calm. And this girl, I'm sure she was in a turmoil inside, but outwardly you would never know it, and they did just a beautiful, beautiful job of conforming to everything. But then came the recessional, and this girl had asked for the main theme of Romeo and Juliet to be played, but the woman hadn't been able to find it, so we didn't have that either. But in the meantime, somebody had gone to check for the reception, and it was a lovely big place and fully adequate for the number of people that were there, but when she got there, they'd had a party there the night before, and nobody had thought to clean it up for the wedding reception the next day, and everything was in a turmoil, and the tables were on top of each other, so she had, the wife of the best man, had to fix the whole thing and clean that. Well, it was really a comedy of errors, but finally we got through it, and everybody had a very relaxed and wonderful time at the reception. It was a beautiful wedding, but I tell you what, we went through to get it there, you wouldn't believe. So we had to practice all of the calmness I'm talking about. I've had many other things happen since I was with you quite some time ago, and many of them have been very, very trying. And many of them I could have become very, very angry about if I had let myself. But in two instances where things happened that were certainly not right, certainly not justified, and I could have been deeply hurt and just off of the people for the rest of my life, I wrestled with it for a few minutes, and in one case a little more than a few minutes. And finally, it was as though these people were my children, and I could just feel them as babies in my arms. And I thought, weren't they wonderful? Weren't they beautiful? Weren't they innocent when they were like this? Why don't I just think about them like that and love them? And instead of resenting or being angry or upset or filled with worry and tension about the things that have happened, why don't I pray for them and see them as coming out of all of these things and being perfect in God? And you know, it was at that very moment that I felt total peace inside of myself. And it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. Very beautiful. And I recommend it to everybody. If we would only do this, if we would, when somebody does something wrong, instead of blaming them or putting them on the spot or denying them or casting them out or making up your mind you're going to get even with them, if we would actually pray for them and see them as perfect, see them as God's children, and do everything we can to be what we should be in God. If we don't do that, are we any better than anyone who causes enmity toward us? Let us ask ourselves that. We have to be the examples ourselves, and we are responsible to God alone. So if we are what we should be in God, we need worry about no man. Now the Master gives a very great explanation here about soul and God. The dynamo of a city can be compared to God, and all the lights of that city sustained by the dynamo can be compared to its souls. Then he says, a soul explained, the relationship of God and the soul may be compared to the moon of the sky and the moon in the pot. I've already told you that one. One moon reflected in many pots of water appears as many. So also God appears as many souls reflected in the waters of various minds and bodies. God is omnipresent, ever conscious, ever newly joyous, biggest being. Soul is an individualized, body-bound, ever conscious, ever newly joyous little being confined by rebirth-making mortal habits and desires. Soul is felt in ecstasy as a perfect but body-confined reflection of God, as a clear moon is seen in a pot of water undisturbed by the breeze. When the pot breaks, the confined image of the moon becomes one with the big sky moon. So, by yoga, the little soul can be seen as an ever-new joyous being undisturbed by the breeze of desires. But when this little soul becomes established in its real perfect nature as the blissful image of God, and completely destroys its identification with the ego, the body-bound pseudo-soul of the wakeful hours, then the liberated soul learns to get out of the three physical, astral, and mental bodies and becomes one with the omnipresent, biggest, ever blissful God. During wakeful hours, through ego, everyone except the true yogi perceives himself as a man or a woman, as so many pounds of flesh, as owner of so many paltry material things. At night, the body-identified soul or ego realizes its own invisible, joyous, true nature in a passive state. The yogi, by practice of yoga and non-attachment, always, at night or by day, beholds himself as a perfect image of ever-blissful God. By meditation and conscious ecstasy, the soul becomes established in its true nature and not in its mortal nature, ego. A strong man slept and dreamt he was a weakling. He was crying for his weak, diseased body. Somebody woke him and told him, "Do you know you were praying for muscles and strength and crying to get rid of your weakness?" "How silly," the strong man said, "that I dream myself to be a weakling when actually I'm strong as a sandow." The soul is drunk with delusion, the somnambulism of daily wakefulness, and acts and grieves like a mortal man. This body-identified state of the soul is called ego. This ego or mortal state of the soul is partially forgotten during the sleep and entirely forgotten during ecstasy. That is why you want to practice ecstasy, to remember that you are truly made in the image of God and get rid of the ego, the nest of all your imaginary troubles. As you are falling asleep every night, keep your eyes half open and consciously enjoy in a relaxed, nonchalant way the state at the border of joyous sleep as long as you can hold it without falling asleep, and you will learn to go into ecstasy at will, ecstasy which is multi-million times more blissful than sleep. Do not use conscious nervous will, for then you will be awake, but use passive will to prolong the enjoyment of the half-awake, half-asleep state every night at bedtime. Try to remain in the above state from 5 minutes to 1 hour. Then you will know about conscious communion of your soul and God, or yoga, because that is the meaning of the word yoga. Conscious oneness with God. It means the yoke. I and my Father are one. This is a tremendous lesson. You know, your subconscious mind is ever awake, and it will put into practice exactly what you put into it. So if you keep your mind fully trained upon God, if you love Him with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind, with all of your strength, and your neighbor as yourself, and if you pray to Him night and day, if you do all things for Him alone, asking nothing for yourself, you will find that you are the richest individual in the world. And you will find that you are ecstatic. Every time I speak of God, I go up into the mountain of my own being, my own consciousness. I am totally unaware of my body. Many times, I close my eyes. I am not even seeing any of you because I am so absorbed in Him. I am so filled with the bliss of His presence, with His power, that I am just taken over. And it is He who speaks through me, who thinks through me, who acts through me. Now, while I was down in Santa Rosa, I picked up perhaps 3 students. And one man came and sat at the table where we were sitting at the reception. And he was sitting across. He started asking me questions. And we started talking about books. And he told me he'd tell me how to write mine. So I told him I'd be glad to listen to that. So we talked about that for a while. Then others came. And finally he got up and he went away. But he came back and he sat in a different spot. And Patty was sitting between us. So she got up and left so we could be alone. And this man evidenced such a tremendous change during perhaps the hour that we talked that it was unbelievable. He was ripe and ready. He was a fantastic soul, just beautiful. Then the bridegroom said he was an atheist in the beginning. He didn't really believe in God. His wife was Jewish, and she had had some tremendous experiences, but they had been more in the psychic state. And some of them had been as though she's leaving her body and things of this nature. But we talked about all of these things, and this was from really 12 o'clock until we left at 4:45, so to speak. And so I was working for God all this time. But as we talked, the atmosphere in that room changed. Everybody changed. Everybody was lifted up. And all of a sudden, this girl said to me, "Do you know anything about auras? And their color?" And I said, "What they mean?" And I said, "Well, yes, I know a few things about them." I said, "For instance, if you see a white aura around somebody's head or a yellow aura, it's an emanation from the electrical body that governs and controls your nervous system." I said, "It means that that one is a very highly developed spiritual being." And she said, well, I've never known anything about him before, but she said, I just see a tremendous aura in you. You're just a blaze of life and light, and I wish it would go away, and yet I don't. So apparently, I wasn't even aware of it, but apparently God had taken this means of showing her something, you see, and yet I didn't do anything about it myself. This has happened with many, many times. I disappear totally and my whole body is filled with light, or my body disappears and the master stands before me. Gordon can verify this. He's had this experience. Anyway, it's a very interesting thing when you get into the things of the Spirit, because there are so many things, as all of you know by now, that are so far beyond anything that we are taught in our everyday life. In the schools where we are taught reading, writing, arithmetic, the arts, the sciences, and all of that. But the science of going to God is the greatest science there is, and it encompasses everything there is in the universe. That's why it's so fascinating. That's why it's so interesting. It's the most wonderful adventure that any man can go into, because he's exploring the depths of his own being. And as I said, he has a whole universe within himself. And as he fixes his attention upon God, God will lift him up, and he will reveal things to him which he never dreamed existed within himself. And not only within himself, but he will give him much information. He will realize through experience the bliss, the ecstasy of God. And he will walk the earth, not as a slave, as a groveling worm, so to speak, just kicked around by the things of his senses, all the worries and the cares, but he will walk the earth as a God-man, filled with the light and the bliss of God.